Chapter 16. Lessons to Eat By. You don't get cake and ice cream when you're finished. The advantage of covering the field of obesity, nutrition, and chronic disease as a journalist rather than as a physician or a researcher or a blogger, as I noted earlier, is that the job ultimately is to learn from people who have firsthand observations of the subject in question. The more such people you speak with, the more you learn. As I also noted earlier, I spent half a year interviewing physicians who now prescribe LCHF ketogenic eating in their clinics and dietitians who prescribe them to their clients and eat this way themselves, as well as a few dozen other healthcare practitioners. Among the physicians were those who struggled to get this dietary message across in the 15 minutes that their healthcare system allowed them to allot to each patient, and others who had transformed their entire practices to focus on weight control and the prescription of LCHF ketogenic eating, and had hired only nurses, dietitians, and staff physicians who bought into this paradigm as well. Charles Cavo, for instance, began his medical career as an obstetrician-gynecologist working in central Connecticut. In 2012, he decided that he would be failing in his job if he did not also provide his patients with counseling for obesity and diabetes. When his partners weren't interested and thought he was crazy, he started his obesity medicine practice on the side, giving advice, he told me, to two people in his kitchen. He has now seen and prescribed LCHF ketogenic eating to over 15,000 patients and had to leave his OBGYN partnership to keep up with the obesity practice. Two of the physicians I interviewed, Sean Burke in Northern California and Gary Kim in Southern California, had established chains of weight loss, weight management clinics that originally counseled clients to use traditional calorie-restricted diets, even very low-calorie diets for weight loss, and then evolved over time to prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating instead. Burke, a Yale-educated emergency medicine physician, is the co-founder of the dozen Jumpstart MD clinics in the San Francisco Bay Area. He told me that some 50,000 patients had come to these clinics looking for advice on controlling their weight since he opened the first one in January 2007. This is, in effect, his clinical experience. With his Jumpstart MD colleagues and a collaborator at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Burke recently published a paper in the Journal of Obesity on the results from over 24,000 of these patients for whom he had complete clinical data. The program, he said, originally counseled a broadly calorie-restricted approach, low in everything, and its patients achieved what Burke called reasonably good results so far as weight loss was concerned. But the patients were also, not surprisingly, always hungry, and they would have to deal with that hunger forever if they wanted to maintain that weight loss. We were seeing better results in the lower carb, higher fat state, Burke said. We were seeing people who were just less miserable and less dependent on medications to suppress their appetites. If they embraced the low carbohydrate, high fat, they found it a broadly more sustainable way to eat, with a better flavor profile, greater satiety, and greater craving reduction. Over time, medications were not as necessary, and the lifestyle feels more sustainable to them if they embraced it. That last clause, which Burke repeated twice, has always been the critical one in any dietary program. If they, i.e. you or me, embrace it, it will work. I've tried to provide the rationale, biological and historical, for why LCHF ketogenic eating is worth the effort. But you have to make that effort. Believing in what you're doing and doing it for the right reasons are both essential conditions for success. Before giving the simple practical advice I gathered in the course of my interviews, I want to share six lessons that capture the essence of the practice of LCHF ketogenic eating, what we're trying to achieve, and how to go about doing it. In short, I want to suggest how you should think about how to eat in order to achieve and maintain health and a healthy weight. Five of the lessons are from the practitioners I interviewed for this book. But the first is from Michael Pollan and his 2008 bestseller, In Defense of Food. Much of this book has been a repudiation, mostly implicit but not always, of the relevance to those of us who are not naturally lean and healthy, of Pollan's otherwise seemingly sensible mantra, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. For us, not too much is meaningless. Mostly plants is not ideal and may be to our detriment, ideal as it may be for the animals and maybe even the environment, although that too is not as simple as it is often portrayed. Even the advice to eat food rather than food-like substances is something on which I often find myself bristling. Not because I don't believe eating whole foods is an essential component of healthy eating, which I do. Footnote. I get nervous when I see keto or paleo-friendly, highly processed food-like substances now appearing in markets and online, sweetened with coconut sugar or non-caloric sweeteners or anything else. They may be benign, but they also may not be. But it's far from sufficient to imply that if a food is not processed, it's benign, at least for those who are predisposed to put on fat. As clever as this wording is, and as much as I often invoke Pollan's food-like substance terminology myself when discussing / arguing with my family about the pros and cons of snack foods, the implication is that this is enough to guide those who are not lean and healthy back to health. It's not. Just eat real food is perfectly wonderful advice for preventive medicine. As the San Antonio physician Jennifer Hendricks, founder of the Women's Physicians Weigh In Facebook group with over 13,000 members as of fall 2019, said to me. But once a person has obesity, and particularly obesity with comorbidities like diabetes and hypertension, it's much more complicated. I've never seen anyone who has had a weight problem their whole life have the weight go away merely by changing to a real food diet, because some of those real foods are still fattening. 1. Many of the policies will also strike you as involving more work. In order to eat well, we have to invest more time, effort, and resources in providing for our sustenance, to dust off a word, than most of us do today. Michael Pollan and I have disagreed on many points, but not on this message from In Defense of Food. Getting healthy and staying healthy, regardless of weight, involves work and a lifetime commitment. This is true of all thoughtful advice on diet and health. How we eat plays a critical role. As informed physical trainers will tell their clients, you cannot outrun a bad diet. Eating healthy requires thought, planning, and more work than simply reaching for the default choices easily available in our daily lives. As Pollan implies, it's certainly not the kind of thing that we're typically trying to do when we're pursuing food that's cheap, fast, and easy, as the standard American diet typifies. Even then, though, it's not impossible. It just requires greater effort. The practitioners I interviewed were unanimous in their belief that LCHF ketogenic eating will lead to improved health and substantial weight loss without hunger, for all but the rare exceptions. But we have to be willing to embrace it, to make the effort to commit to eating as prescribed. Those who succeed are those who come to think of abstaining from carbohydrate-rich foods as critically important to their health, in the same way that ex-smokers consider continued abstinence from cigarettes vitally important, and members of Alcoholics Anonymous consider the act of abstaining from drinking. This means you will have to figure out how to avoid temptation in a world that will serve it up, literally by the platefuls. We live in a carb-centric world, as Kathleen Lopez, a dietitian who teaches at Illinois' Dominican University, said to me. Everywhere you go, everyone is eating ice cream and potato chips, and you're there, and you're not. For some people, that is not difficult at all. It's an even trade-off for their improved health. For other people, it's torturous. For those who do embrace this new way of eating, some will get healthier and leaner than others, but all should get healthier and eventually find it easy to do. This is true of the process of breaking any addiction. In this case, the replacement of carbohydrate-rich foods with fat-rich ones should provide the pleasure and joy in eating that might not come from the kind of low-fat, calorie-restricted meals we've been told since the 1970s that we have to eat to avoid heart disease and remain lean. It does not require a lifetime of hunger, only a lifetime of abstinence from a specific food group that for us, but not everyone, is harmful. 2. This is not something you are going to do. This is what you are going to become. This is what Ken Berry, a physician with a practice in rural Tennessee, tells his patients when they come to him looking for advice. Berry has been practicing since 2003 and began prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating to his obese, insulin-resistant, and diabetic patients half a dozen years later. He's also the author of a 2017 book, Lies My Doctor Told Me, largely about the benefits of LCHF ketogenic eating, specifically compared to the low-fat, calorie-restricted advice our doctors have been traditionally passing along. By Berry's advice that this is what you are going to become, he means his patients are going to become people who are as meticulous about what they eat and how they eat as they might be in any other area of their professional or personal life. Berry's conversion experience is typical of many of the physicians I interviewed. He started putting on excess fat in his mid-30s and believed, based on what he described as the 4 hours of nutrition education we got in medical school, that if you want to lose weight, you create a calorie deficit. He assumed that if he religiously followed this state-of-the-art wisdom, it would fix him. It didn't. So now I look like a fat, lazy doctor with stiff joints and reflux and allergies, he told me. I felt like shit all the time, and I'm supposed to go into a patient's room with my gut hanging over my pants and tell him what to do. How does that work? Instead, he read the South Beach Diet, which took him to Atkins, and Lauren Cordain's book on paleo eating, and then The Primal Blueprint by Mark Sisson. Finally, he started looking into ketogenic diets and the benefits of intermittent fasting. Along the way, he changed what he ate and saw immediate results. Even his allergies and reflux went away, he said, which he attributes specifically to giving up dairy. I came to the conclusion that everything I was telling my patients to do and not to do was exactly wrong. This is not a fun or comfortable realization as a professional who's supposed to know what the hell he's talking about. Now, Berry freely acknowledges to his patients that he sounds like a witch doctor with a panacea when he counsels them how to eat. But he believes, based on his clinical experience, that LCHF ketogenic eating resolves a host of conditions, including obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. The key, of course, is getting his patients to believe it as well. Berry is among the many physicians and dietitians I interviewed who stressed the importance of patients going down the rabbit hole or doing the homework, as he did, that they make the effort to learn why they should eat as he advises and what to expect. The patients who succeed, these physicians agreed, tended to be those who could be induced to read at least some of the copious literature on LCHF ketogenic eating that's now available. They had to become people who cared enough to do the work. I'm pointing out to them websites, pointing out books to read, Berry says, and if somebody is not willing to do that, if they're not ready to do their homework, they're probably not ready to change. That's fine if that's the case, even if they're becoming diabetic, and I'll tell them so. But I'll also tell them that I will see them in a couple of years when they're getting started on insulin for their diabetes and might be a little more motivated. 3. You don't get cake and ice cream when you're finished. Nick Miller, a dentist who has a practice in the Pittsburgh suburbs, said this to me. It's what Miller tells his patients in conveying the idea that this is a lifetime commitment. Miller's conversion experience was another common one. He graduated from high school at 190 pounds, a 6'2" athlete. 8 years out of dental school, his weight had ballooned to 280 pounds. It happened, he said, despite his running 50-plus miles each week and trying to avoid bad foods. Miller's trip down the rabbit hole began with a podcast in which Vinny Tortorich, a fitness trainer in Los Angeles and now an author and documentary filmmaker, was discussing LCHF ketogenic eating. Then Miller started reading Nina Teicholz's The Big Fat Surprise, Jason Fung's The Obesity Code, and my books. With a biochemistry background from college, Miller thought he was a reasonable judge of what was sensible and what wasn't. And LCHF ketogenic eating made sense to him, so he tried it. 3 years later, he was down to 210 pounds, eating eggs, meat, and green vegetables. He'd like to get back to 190 pounds eventually, although, he said, that may be delusional. As a dentist, Miller has a unique perspective. He sees the damage to the teeth and gums that comes with eating processed carbohydrates and sugars. Many of his patients, he said, are pre-diabetic or have diabetes. Some have gout and sleep apnea or a whole list of metabolic disorders, and their oral cavity is breaking down. Since Miller typically sees these patients at least twice a year, and he has plenty of time to talk to them while he works on their teeth, he does. They're a captive audience, and he believes they are a receptive one. They notice Miller's weight loss and ask him how he achieved it. It was not the result of a diet, Miller tells his patients, but rather a new way of eating that he would adhere to for the rest of his life. In the traditional world of healthy eating, cake and ice cream in moderation are perfectly fine, particularly as a celebration. But when we are eating to treat a metabolic disorder, we must maintain that treatment for life. That state of remission, whether from obesity, diabetes, hypertension, or one of the many other disorders that LCHF ketogenic eating seems to resolve, at least anecdotally, must be adhered to without limit. A little bit of cake and ice cream won't hurt you. That's not the point. You have to work hard to retain your discipline. If you indulge too soon, no matter how traditionally healthy the treats, no matter how whole and organic the food, how few the ingredients, you put your personal progress at risk. This, again, is one reason many of the physicians I interviewed who have clinics dedicated to weight loss and maintenance and treating diabetes with LCHF ketogenic eating often talk in terms of breaking an addiction to carbohydrate-rich foods. There's a good reason, as Miller said to me, why alcoholics don't celebrate the successful completion of a 28-day rehab program with a champagne toast. 4. If you do fall off the wagon, at least you know there's a wagon to get back on. These words of advice, obviously, also come from the drug and alcohol addiction world. I heard them from Catherine Kasha, a family medicine doctor in Edmonton, Canada. Catherine is a lacto-vegetarian. She avoids meat, fish, and fowl, but not eggs and dairy, and has been since birth. She described herself as having always had a weight problem. "I still do," she told me. At one point, she lost 50 pounds by the conventional approach and then had what she calls an epic regain and put on 110 pounds in 4 years. "I remember my husband saying, 'How is this happening with what you're eating?'" Kasha came to LCHF ketogenic eating through social media and then by reading Jason Fung's work. "It clicked," she said. She gave up her morning oatmeal and ate instead a lot of eggs, a fair bit of cheese. Cottage cheese became a primary source of protein for her, in addition to high-fat dairy and tofu. She eats lots of veggies. She makes her own yogurt and dresses it up with chia seeds and pumpkin seeds and unsweetened coconut. She bakes still, although now with almond and coconut flour rather than wheat flour. She sweetens with a combination of erythritol, stevia, xylitol, and monk fruit. "I'm not sure about this other stuff," she says, "but I am certain sugar is bad for me." Kasha doesn't necessarily recommend her vegetarian eating to her patients. "I'm still going to tell you, if you don't have an ethical issue, eat the damn meat," she said. "You get bonus points if it's grass-fed. It's the easiest way to get a nutrient-rich meal. There are a lot of ways, though, to do this right. There is no one way." On LCHF, Kasha had lost significant weight, but she still finds it difficult to maintain, an ongoing struggle to avoid slipping off the wagon, particularly during holidays and family celebrations. She knows LCHF ketogenic eating works for herself and others. "I've had patients who do incredibly well," she said. "It's phenomenal what can be done." But she wants them to understand that commitment doesn't preclude falling off the wagon on occasion. The important thing is remembering that the next step is to get back on the wagon. It's to go back to abstaining from sugars, grains, and most starches. Andrew Samus, a critical care physician and assistant professor in the surgery department at Queen's University in Ontario, told me that he communicates the same message to patients using a cigarette-related metaphor. One of the things you talk about when you do smoking cessation training, he said, is what to do when you find yourself smoking again. What tends to happen in human nature is people quit smoking for 6 months, then slip and go back. One of the smoking cessation doctors gave me a metaphor I can now use with my patients. Every day I drive to work, I try to hit as many green lights in a row as I can. But if I hit a red light, or even 5 in a row, I don't turn around and go back home. I just try again from there. I still try to see how many green lights I can hit. For smoking cessation, they say as soon as you can muster the willpower to drop the cigarette and stamp it out, do it, and keep trying to be a non-smoker. What we're talking about here is a similar issue. Once people understand it's still cognition over desire, they can go back to being someone who doesn't eat these foods. 5. It's not a religion. It's about how I feel. This message comes from Carrie Diulis, a spine surgeon in Akron, Ohio. I won the genetic lottery, she told me in jest. I have celiac disease. I should be a 350-pound, insomniac, acne-laden person. But I have figured out how to work with my genetics. Extreme obesity runs in her family, Diulis said. She became a vegetarian when she was 12 years old. Her motivation was a combination of concern about animal welfare and thinking that a very low-fat diet, as prescribed then by Nathan Pritikin, was the single best thing she could do for her own health. Her life since then was a continual series of self-experiments as she looked for a way to eat that would keep her healthy and at a healthy weight. Diulis's experience is an extreme example of the challenge. She told me that she entered college at a normal weight. But the freshman 15 pounds of weight gain, for me, was more like the freshman 50. Over the next 20 years, she yo-yoed in and out of obesity and diets. She was 100 pounds overweight when she finished college and entered medical school. She managed to bring her weight back down, eating a plant-based, calorie-restricted diet and exercising obsessively, eventually running marathons. I was working out about 20 hours a week, she says, and significantly limiting my calories, and was able to be lean at that point. But boy, any deviation from that, and weight came on really easily. She gained 60 pounds when pregnant with her daughter, and a bunch of weight during pregnancy with her son 4 years later. She tried a low-fat, calorie-restricted vegan diet, but couldn't lose weight even while nursing. I could have won an Olympic competition in calorie counting, she said, but there is all this hormonal stuff going on nursing a baby. There are women for whom weight just drops off when they're nursing. Not me. This is not a thermodynamic issue. It was a truly hormonal thing. In her late 30s, while working at the Cleveland Clinic, Diulis was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Her doctors, following the conventional treatment plan, advised her to take insulin and then eat carbohydrates to balance out the insulin injections. If she didn't balance the insulin precisely with the carbohydrates, though, her blood sugar would crash, and that would impact her ability to function. For a surgeon, she acknowledged, that's a disaster. Her solution was to stop eating grains, starches, and sugars entirely, add fat to her then pescatarian fish and plants diet, get into ketosis, and stay there. She then transitioned to a more standard ketogenic diet, eating meat on occasion as well. Eventually, though, she found her health markers improved significantly when she avoided meat and other animal products and ate a vegan ketogenic diet. She would still have to take insulin as a type 1 diabetic, but her diet would minimize the necessary insulin dose as well as the blood sugar swings that came with the carbohydrates. Like Catherine Kasha, she recommends her patients eat meat if they have no ethical issues doing so, but she doesn't herself. Her decision is still driven by ethical and environmental concerns, as well as by the simple fact that she doesn't feel healthy when she eats meat. The same, she said, is true of dairy and eggs. Diulis maintains her vegan ketogenic diet because it works for her. She feels healthy on it. If I feel I need to eat meat or fish, she said, I'll go back to them. But at this point, I feel great. I'm on less insulin than ever, maintaining normal blood sugars most of the time, and my labs are all in the range I want them. I have no reason to do anything different. Like many of the physicians I interviewed, Daoulas no longer eats breakfast. She finds that she's not hungry in the morning and functions fine without it. For lunch, she'll typically have homemade kale and Brussels sprout chips with baro and macadamia nuts, or a smoothie she makes herself, consisting of kale, chard, dandelion greens, arugula, sunflower sprouts, broccoli sprouts, she grows these herself, half an avocado, juice from half a lemon, the sweetener stevia, and a tablespoon of MCT, medium-chain triglyceride oil. She'll occasionally add protein powder made from ground Sasha Inchi seeds or pea protein. She also adds 20 grams of pure fiber, psyllium husk powder, that slows down the digestion of the carbohydrates. I never get hungry in surgery anymore, she told me. I'm cranking away in ketosis. My head is clearer than it's ever been. I'm hungry when I get home in the evening, but I'm not ravenous. For dinners, her protein source is typically tempeh, tofu, made from either soy or hemp, black soybeans, lupini beans, or nut butters, specifically almond butter. She uses avocado oil and coconut oil for cooking, and olive oil for salads and cold dishes. She makes a bread from tahini and almond flour, and makes her own chocolate with coconut oil, cacao powder, and chai spices. She'll snack on nori, seaweed sheets, with olive oil and salt. Cauliflower rice is also a staple. For the first time in her life, she told me, she has to work to keep weight on. That's shocking because I am a perimenopausal woman who was morbidly obese at one point. So this is working really, really well at the moment for me. If that changes, I'll adjust. It's not a religion. Quite a few of the physicians and dietitians I interviewed are vegetarians who found a way to eat that works for them, that they find ethically defensible or that fits their religious precepts, but also critically, as Daoulas phrased it, allows them to feel healthy. They reached that point through a process of informed elimination and self-experimentation. What makes this interesting is that a few of the physicians I interviewed are now exclusively carnivores, not through any belief that this is the healthiest diet, but because it allows them to feel healthy. It works for them in a way that omnivorous or vegetarian eating did not. One of those is Georgia Ead, who has worked as a psychiatrist for both Harvard University and Smith College. Abstaining from grains, starchy vegetables, and sugars can be 100% of the solution for some people, Ead said in our interview, but only 80 or 90% for others, as it was for her. The rest of us who still struggle, we have things we have to tweak. Like Daoulas, Ead comes from a family that is predisposed to extreme obesity. Her grandmother on her mother's side weighed 400 pounds, she told me, and all the women in her immediate family have struggled with their weight. Ead was overweight as a child and said that until about age 40, she was always on a low-calorie, low-fat, high-exercise regime. As she got older, she found it increasingly difficult to maintain a healthy weight, even as she progressively ate fewer calories and ran more miles. In her medical residency, she no longer had the time or energy to keep up with the combination of running and semi-starvation, and her weight ballooned to 190 pounds. After her mother lost 90 pounds following Atkins's advice, Ead began to explore variations on LCHF ketogenic eating herself, beginning with the South Beach diet, which seemed to her the healthiest. Eventually, she found she could maintain a healthy weight with LCHF ketogenic eating as long as she avoided dairy. I found that dairy products make me hungry and gain weight, she told me, and for me, I could not eat as much as I wanted. I still had to be careful, and I still had to exercise. But I was able to keep my weight from fluctuating if I ate the right foods. I found my groove with low carb. In her early 40s, though, what worked for Ead stopped working. Her weight remained stable, but she developed migraines, fatigue, and concentration problems, as well as irritable bowel syndrome. She told me she gradually became incapacitated. She started keeping a food and symptom diary. She was working at Harvard at the time, with access, she said, to great doctors, specialists of all kinds. But none of them asked her what she ate. So she started a series of diet experiments herself, avoiding for weeks at a time specific foods that she thought might be troublesome and recording how she felt. Eventually, she got to the point where she was left feeling fantastic, better than I ever had, even when I was a kid. No headaches, great energy, digestion was perfect, great mental stamina. At that point, Ede was eating almost exclusively meat. It was completely the opposite of what we've been told to do, she said. I was floored. I was scared that the diet that corrected my health was going to kill me. And as a psychiatrist, I was fascinated with the other piece of the puzzle. Why was my mood better? My concentration, mental energy, productivity? Why had my depression and anxiety gone away? It never crossed my mind that food could affect the brain like that. And yet for me, at least, it had. Her reading of the literature convinced her that her meat-based diet was safe and healthy. In her early 50s, Ede once again made slight revisions to what she ate in response to changes in her health. I developed some perimenopausal symptoms, she wrote to me in an email, and some of my old familiar symptoms returned as well, including weight gain. In an effort to address these issues, I removed all remaining plant foods from my diet. Eating a plant-free diet, she said, has so far resolved all her health problems, and she lost 24 pounds, all the weight she had gained, plus some. Everyone is so different, Ede said. There are indeed basic principles that apply to everyone, but many of us have foods we're sensitive to, and we have to identify those on our own. 6. Weight loss and weight maintenance are learned skills. You have to practice. This is the message that Sue Wolver tries to reinforce in her patients. Wolver is the Richmond, Virginia physician we met earlier in this book who changed her practice to prescribing LCHF ketogenic eating after visiting Eric Westman's clinic at Duke and seeing his successes. This message needs little elaboration. Wolver told me that she often asks her patients if they would expect to be good at anything in life without practicing, and if they would expect to stay good at it without continuing to practice. We have to practice at anything to get good at it, Wolver says. And the more we practice, the better we'll get, and the easier it will be. You have to put time and effort into developing the skills necessary to do it well for life. This is not practicing to be hungry and living with it, as the conventional thinking has always implied. It's practicing the skills necessary to avoid the foods that make us fat and sick while cooking and eating in a way that brings us pleasure. It's practicing the skills necessary to identify the foods we can eat and the foods we can't, the foods that trigger craving and the foods that trigger weight gain. It's practicing the mental skills necessary to remember, when we're craving carbohydrates, how bad we used to feel when we were eating them, how many pounds heavier we were, how much less healthy we were, and whether the gratification of a donut or a beer will be worth the risk of revisiting that experience.